You're listening to Simpler One Earth Living from Jubilee One Earth Economics and Simple Living Works with co-hosts Lee Van Ham and Jerry Iverson. Today we feature a conversation with Chuck Collins of the Inequality Project, part of the Institute for Policy Studies. Visit ips-dc.org. What Chuck has to say is so important that we encourage you to listen with headphones or earbuds for best clarity.
Over the last few decades, 15% of U.S. wealth has been transferred from 99% of the populace to 1%. The 2018 tax revisions continue that trend, and that means that it may be something you become very aware of as you file the 2018 tax returns. But does the wealthy class benefit from this, really? And are there any benefits to society as a whole when the system is arranged or rigged this way? We hear lots of news on inequality, but where can we turn for strong analysis of how grotesque inequality happens and how it can be corrected? Stay with us and you'll find out.
Greetings, Lee, from Paso Robles, California, and Simple Living Works.
And I greet you, Jerry, from San Diego and Jubilee One Earth Economics. Well, I'm excited that we get to share the voice and thought of Chuck Collins with our listeners. I first became familiar with him through the book Robin Hood Was Right, a book with the subtitle A Guide to Giving Your Money for Social Change. Chuck wrote that along with Joan Garner and Pam Rogers back in 2000. Well, then I was greatly impacted by a subsequent book he wrote with Felice Yeskel, Economic Apartheid in America. That word apartheid really caught me because of all the goings on in South Africa not that many years back. Economic Apartheid in America, with the subtitle A Primer on Economic Inequality and Insecurity, that was published in 2005. That book so clearly explains how the economic system can lessen the economic divides in our society and how it can increase them. So subsequently, I established a relationship with Chuck, and that came about in a very fortunate circumstance at the Solidarity Economic Forum in Amherst, Massachusetts in 2009. When I wrote my first book, Blinded by Progress, Chuck agreed to write the foreword, and I'm very grateful for that.
By the way, the Institute for Policy Studies, or IPS, is a progressive think tank dedicated to building a more equitable, ecologically sustainable, and peaceful society. In partnership with dynamic social movements, they turn transformative policy ideas into action. Its work includes economic justice, racial and gender justice, climate justice, peace and foreign policy, and leadership programs. As Program Director of Inequality and the Common Good, Chuck Collins edits the Inequality This Week e-newsletter. In fact, a good way to appreciate why Chuck can speak with authority to inequality and the racial wealth divide is to scan the titles of his writings. I'll read some of them here. You'll no doubt hear some you want to read, so go to the show notes for links. He's the author of the popular book Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. His new book, Is Inequality America Irreversible?, is published by Oxford, UK, Polity Press. He's also written 99-1, How Wealth Inequality is Wrecking the World and What We Can Do About It. He is co-author with Bill Gates Sr. of Wealth and Our Commonwealth in 2003. A Case for Taxing Inherited Fortunes. Chuck's work with wealth persons led to co-founding Wealth for the Common Good, a network for business leaders, high-income households, and partners working together to promote shared prosperity and fair taxation. This network merged in 2015 with the Patriotic Millionaires. He co-authored The Moral Measure of the Economy with Mary Wright. It's a book about Christian ethics and the economic life. He's also co-author of several IPS reports, including The Road to Zero Wealth, How the Race Wealth Divide is Hollowing Out America's Middle Class, Billionaire Bonanza, The Forbes 400 and the Rest of Us, and Gilded Giving, top-heavy philanthropy in an age of extreme inequality. Here's our conversation, recorded this February. For best results, please use earbuds or headphones. So, Chuck, I understand that you come from a family of means, but you have set that aside and instead are working on the Inequality Project. Can you tell us your personal story? What happened that made you change directions?
Well, I grew up in a wealthy family, the great-grandson of the meatpacker Oscar Mayer. And so I would say I was born on third base, born into, essentially winning the lottery at birth. And I grew up in the suburbs of Detroit. And I remember at the age of seven, the Detroit riots, the uprising in Detroit broke out. And I was like any curious kid, just trying to understand. And at that moment, I really got a window into the great inequalities that existed between city and suburb, rich and poor, black and white. And that planted a seed in me. And as I grew older, I, got to understand how these inequalities really infused every aspect of our lives. I also did some work with Catholic Relief Services in El Salvador and had other experiences that sort of gave me a global picture of how inequality was working. So by the time I was in my mid-20s and actually had control over the inheritance that had been passed my way, I made the decision to give it away, thinking that it would somehow radically change my life trajectory. What I realized was I still had a lot of other advantages that were kind of hardwired into my life. But it's gotten me, it launched me on a life work of trying to address these extreme inequalities of income, wealth, and power.
Well, now you are a leader in the Institute for Policy Studies, more specifically the Inequality Project. Tell us about IPS and about the project.
Well, for about 13 years, I have directed this program that looks at the impact of these inequalities, why they matter on our democracy and society, and also the kind of racial dimensions of the racial wealth divide. And we also started a website called inequality.org, which is kind of a portal for commentary and analysis. And we even try to have a little bit of a sense of humor and hope as we engage on these matters. We do a couple of annual reports that look at the concentration of wealth at the very top. We also look at the problems related to what I call hidden wealth, the trillions of dollars that are kind of vanishing off the balance sheet, if you will, and are hidden offshore or in trusts. And we look at the impact on philanthropy and the independent sector when so much giving is now controlled by a limited number of multi-millionaires and billionaires. So that's a lot of the work I do on a daily basis, as well as kind of work with coalitions and campaigns that are trying to, affect the rules and policies that worsen inequality or could alleviate inequality.
Would you think of yourself as a think tank?
Yeah, I think we are a think and do tank. The Institute for Policy Studies was founded in 1963 by people who wanted to put ideas into action. So we're not just sitting around writing papers and just talking to ourselves. We're kind of allied with and in service of social movements that are trying to actually change things. So, for instance, there's a group in California of students working to press for a College for All initiative. And we work with them to do reports and research and come up with ways that they could pay for a universal expanded College for All program. So that we're very applied in that sense.
So you're providing the research backbone for a number of activist groups.
That's right. And we you know, we have the relationships where we can listen and engage with them. We've staffed, you know, Reverend Barber and the Poor People's Campaign at the national level. We've been kind of the research arm of the Poor People's Campaign, for example. We work with Jobs with Justice, the People's Action, Right to the City. We're looking a lot at how luxury real estate now is disrupting local housing markets and pushing up the cost of housing and what we can do about that. So, you know, the problems are sort of bubbling up from the community level, and we try to be supportive and assistance to those efforts.
Well, I understand that you're pretty well known for your book, Economic Apartheid. Tell us a little about that, and also if you have a new book.
Yeah, we did a number of editions of a book called Economic Apartheid in America that was very, very popular in classrooms and with students. The most recent book I did is, or the most well-known book is called Born on Third Base, and it's a one-percenter makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good. And it's really a book about how advantage works. So it has a bit more of my own personal reflections on that and more stories, narratives, on the whole challenge of how do you change the conversation about inequality. And I have a new policy book called Is Inequality in America Irreversible? Which is a short, mercifully short book on what are the policies and rule changes that will make a difference. So those are some of the books I've done. I actually had the opportunity to work with Bill Gates' dad, and we did a book called Wealth and Our Commonwealth, Why America Should Tax Accumulated Fortunes. And it continues to be relevant every day because it's really a book about why we should retain our national estate tax, which is constantly under attack, a tax that's only paid by really the top, you know, 98.8%, you know, it exempts 98.8% of taxpayers. It's only paid by a tiny sliver of multimillionaires and billionaires. And Bill Gates' dad has been a very outspoken champion of why we should keep that tax, and he and I have done a lot of writing and work on that issue.
Well, now we should dig a little deeper because even though you deal with international inequality, I think your focus is primarily on the U.S. And what is in this economic system that allows such great wealth and extreme inequality?
Well, if I were to summarize it, I would put it on a bumper sticker that we're living through the Judas economy, the betrayal of work and the triumph of capital. Meaning that the rules of the economy have benefited asset owners, people with wealth, at the expense of people who work. And whether those rules are tax policy or trade agreements or corporate practices or government regulations or lack thereof, the rules have been tilted to benefit those with wealth and assets. And if you do that for 30, 40 years, lo and behold, you create a society that is pulling apart and polarizing. So now I would describe the dynamic, the physics of inequality, if you will, as compounding advantages for the super haves and compounding or accelerating disadvantage for everyone else. And that's the moment we're living in. We're living in a period of extreme and extraordinary inequality. And the concentration of wealth has reached levels maybe not seen ever in the United States, although 100 years ago, we also had a period of extreme inequality as we do today. So we have a situation now where the wealthiest 400 billionaires have as much wealth as the bottom 64% of all U.S. households combined. And 3 billionaires, Buffett, Gates, and Bezos, have as much wealth as half of all U.S. households combined. So that is, and that comes from our own research study we do every year called Billionaire Bonanza. And it's really unprecedented in our lifetimes, the levels of inequality.
Would you say this is a flaw of capitalism?
Yeah, I would say it is the way in the United States our particular flavor of capitalism is wired, meaning we kind of have a system of unfettered, highly individualistic capitalism. You could go to Canada, or you could go to the Nordic countries, which are also, you know, have robust capitalist societies, but you would not find the same extreme levels of inequality. And the reason being, they have a higher floor, a decency floor, a social safety net through which few people can fall. And they also tax and regulate wealth and capital at the higher level. And so they create more, you know, bumper lanes, if you will, for the market economy, whereas ours is kind of, hyper unregulated and growing more so. So I would say that capitalism, left to its own devices, creates extreme inequalities that then sort of cannibalize themselves, meaning people use their wealth and power to get more wealth and power, and it corrupts and corrodes the whole system. That is, left to its own devices, a flaw in capitalism. But there are ways to protect the commons and create rules which would mean a less hyper-extreme capitalism and less inequality.
Why don't you give us some examples, Chuck, of rules that could do that?
Well, I think there are things we could obviously do to lift the floor better, meaning a living wage floor, universal health insurance, a guaranteed universal basic income, decency standards through which people could not fall. So that those kinds of rules would make a huge difference. We could make public investments in things that make it possible for non-rich people to have a decent life, investing in, affordable housing, a social housing sector, so people are not out in the market trying to compete for a basic need of shelter, access to education, higher education that doesn't put you in debt for decades. And then I think we have to address the sort of distorting effects of concentrated wealth and power. And that's where a robust inheritance tax makes a lot of sense. A wealth tax that taxes wealth above a very high level, say about $50 million, a progressive income tax. All those things together would reduce that distorting impact of concentrated wealth and power on our democracy, on the economy, on philanthropy and society.
Well, it's amazing to me how frequently your byline shows up in publications, and a whole wide variety of publications. It seems like you're in pretty high demand for articles in numerous publications.
Well, we're trying our best to get the word out, and it's not just me. I mean, there's a team of us who write and engage and talk to people like yourselves who have, terrific podcasts, which is a way a lot of people are learning about what's happening in society right now. We try to have the conversation happen. And I should say, the conversation is getting more robust. I mean, 5 years ago, I think the attention focused on inequality was not as great as it is today. I think people are recognizing it's really not in anyone's interest to keep going down this path. And I would argue it's not in the interest of people like me who grew up in a wealthy circumstance, or people with wealth. But extreme inequality undermines the quality of life for everybody. And now there's a mountain of research that shows that it's bad for public health. It's bad for our inner well-being. There's a current book out called The Inner Level, which looks at our sort of psychological and spiritual well-being and how inequality undermines that. It undermines our sense of solidarity and that we're all in it together. So part of my work, you know, with the book Born on Third Base, or talking through networks like the Patriotic Millionaires, is to talk to my fellow one percenters and say, you know, we really don't want to keep going down this path. We don't want to become an apartheid society.
We'll return momentarily to our conversation with Chuck Collins of the Inequality Project. I want to invite you to travel with One Earth Jubilee to the Jubilee Circles in Mexico. Rachel Miller Houghton, actually, Rachel is there this very minute as we record this, doing an exploratory for the upcoming delegation, and she'll be leading the next delegation. So we want you to be part of it. Going to see is the best way to really understand how resistance to unsustainable multi-earth living is being practiced by people in the Mexican states of Puebla and Chiapas. The delegations visit both of those states. It's inspiring to see the ways One Earth Living is being shaped by people in these circles there, and then the many low-income and indigenous peoples with whom they work. Well, let us know of your interest. You're sure to have questions, and we'll give you the best answers we can so that you can make a decision that's right for you. But for our part, we encourage you to come with us and see for yourself. You'll go to fascinating places tourists never go. Oh, and a few they do. So let us hear from you. Well, now let's return to our conversation with Chuck Collins.
Since this is coming up on tax season, I think we're going to get a little more specific, because with the new tax laws that were an enormous giveaway to the wealthy and to corporations, there are some other hidden kinds of things that I'd like to point out and have you comment on. For example, with the new tax laws, the standard deduction has been doubled, which sounds like a good thing. But I'm kind of wondering, there are some possible side effects to that. So one might be more people will be using the standard deduction because it's so much greater than rather than itemizing. Now, it seems to me that might be a way of reducing the size of the IRS, since they'll have so many fewer itemized deductions to go through, and therefore making it easier for the rich, because there's a good chance they won't be audited. Am I on the right track here?
Yeah, I think that is one of the concerns. I actually think raising the standard deduction or increasing what I would call the no tax threshold is not a bad thing. It does make sense to simplify the tax code for, you know, 90% of the people who file. That does not mean we should not keep greater scrutiny. I mean, we've seen a decade-long process, decades, of weakening the IRS's ability to monitor the games people play at the very highest, wealthiest level. But I alluded to earlier this problem of hidden wealth. People are using trusts, they're using business assets, they're using all kinds of games to shelter money and avoid taxes and move it offshore, both wealthy individuals and global transnational companies are playing these games. And I think you're right, Jerry. We should make sure the IRS has the tools and the resources to shut down some of the most egregious loopholes and games that wealthy and global corporations are playing. But I think there, a lot of people are waking up as they're doing their taxes this year to the reality that they did not get the promised tax break. In fact, you know, they might be paying more taxes. And here's this, you know, almost $2 trillion tax cut that passed at the end of 2017. That is just an extraordinary windfall, mostly for, you know, a couple hundred global corporations, and some very wealthy one percenters. But that's where the benefit went. The benefit to society was nil. And, you know, people are waking up to that. And that's fascinating because there's now more proposals to make the tax system fairer and more progressive. You know, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez proposed, you know, we should restore the top income tax rate to 70%. And, you know, everybody just, you know, went bananas over this until they realized, this is an incredibly popular idea. 70% of the population thinks that that is a good and fair thing to do. And then that was followed by Senator Elizabeth Warren introduced a proposal for a wealth tax, which we don't currently have, an annual wealth tax on wealth, you know, over $50 million, progressive, very progressive on wealth over $1 billion. And this is a really fabulous idea, I think, and it would raise substantial revenue, trillions of dollars over the next decade, and put a brake on that concentration of wealth. And then, the same week that Congress proposed abolishing, Republicans proposed abolishing the estate tax, Senator Bernie Sanders proposed making the estate tax stronger and raising the top rate on wealth estate over $1 billion. And what's interesting is all of these ideas are wildly popular. People are waking up to the fact that we've been bamboozled on the tax front and want to restore the progressivity that existed in previous generations. Like even under, you know, President Dwight Eisenhower, the income tax and the estate tax were considerably more progressive. We're talking about bringing back the Eisenhower tax rates on the wealthy. And, you know, think of this trillions of dollars of revenue that could be raised, that could be invested in accessible education, infrastructure, et cetera. So there's a lot to be gained from moving this conversation forward.
Well, give us a peek in the future, Chuck. What's coming up in the future, short range, long range, for the Institute for Policy Studies and for the Inequality Project?
Well, I think we're going to see more and more pressure building over the course of the coming months. We're going to host a national conference in June on the problem of the extreme concentration of wealth and what to do about it. So we'll be having ongoing conversations and discussions about how do we address the top-heavy wealth situation. We're going to be working all with many, many states on how to raise revenue and invest in things like debt-free higher education. California and Michigan and other states are all looking at ways to reduce the cost of higher education, as well as early childhood education, how to pay for that. We have an agenda to reform philanthropy, to ensure that philanthropy is not just the playground of the super rich, but that, you know, more people have the opportunity to give away and share their wealth and money and income to charities that matter, independent organizations, and make sure that the system is not another avenue for abuse by the billionaire class. All those are things that are wildly popular among the public. Our elected officials are just slowly catching up to where, you know, most people are on these matters. You know, sometimes I think we look at the current extreme inequalities and think, boy, this is going to be tough to change. But I see a real realignment happening. I think there's enormous pressure building from below of people who understand that these inequalities are bad for the economy, bad for civic life, that they accelerate and compound the divisions that already exist in our society. And also, I see wealthy people recognizing that these inequalities are a dead end and that they should play a role in helping reverse them and support social movements to reduce inequality. So I think we could start to see a program of reversing these inequalities pick up the pace quite quickly in the next months and years. So I'm quite optimistic that we're going to be able to turn this around. And I should say, if your listeners are interested in joining in on that movement, they should go to inequality.org, sign up for the little weekly newsletter that we send out that sort of chronicles all the activity in the space. And we really try to lift up both the horrors of inequality, but also the humor and hope and possibility that together we can build an economy that works for everyone.
Now, you are funded by donations.
Yeah, we are a completely independent think tank and activist group. We don't take money from government. We don't take money from corporations. We are supported by individuals and some foundations, and that's how we sustain this work. And we have a lot of small donors who give through inequality.org and support the work. And that gives us a tremendous boost and allows us to keep going further and further. So, but we don't risk our independence. We really try to guard our autonomy to be able to speak out and do the right thing and not be having anybody yank our chain, if you will.
Well, I confess that I get your weekly Inequality This Week email newsletter, and it's really well done. I commend it to anyone that's at all interested in this subject. There are, some of us who really take small-scale charitable giving seriously. And this new standard deduction, I think, is a way of actually suppressing, because people no longer need to itemize their deductions in order to get their deduction. So, My spouse and I are beginning this year practicing something, it's kind of an experiment, called bunching, whereby in odd-numbered years, we double our donations so that we rise above the new standard deduction, because we feel we want to direct money in positive ways, where if we give that money through our taxes, half of it will go to the military and the war machine. So do you have any comment on this concept of bunching? Then we give political contributions that are not tax deductible in even numbered years when there are elections.
Well, I think the idea of bunching gifts and giving tax exempt gifts in odd years and political gifts in even years is a brilliant way to use our leverage as smaller donors. And one of the risks of the raising the standard deduction is that it takes away the incentive for charitable giving. It reduces it. I think charities are going to take a big hit, and they will become even more dependent on the wealthy donors. Almost all the growth in philanthropic giving in the last couple of years has been from mega gifts, people giving $100 million gifts or more to hospitals or universities. And it's weakening the power and the clout of small donors. And if we want to have a vibrant, independent sector and also support social change organizations, those of us who are not big donors now, and I put myself in that category now, should follow a strategy like that you've articulated. Bundling gifts to tax-exempt organizations, raising up enough to get above the standard deduction and get a real deduction, and then giving non-tax-exempt gifts to, small gifts make a huge difference, and they will continue to help social movement activists get on the ballot and get elected. So I think it's a very, very smart strategy.
Thank you. What scares me is that really wealthy people can give endowed chairs to universities, for example, and have some influence on who's hired and who's teaching future generations when it comes to business and economics.
Yeah, one of the things that, we do with this report called Gilded Giving, Top-Heavy Philanthropy in the Age of Inequality. And we should all be very alarmed at how wealthy people are using the philanthropic system to advance a very narrow agenda. And of course, there are exceptions to this, and there are people who are giving money and, you know, supporting the works of mercy and doing good, smart social change giving. But that's a tiny sliver, and that a lot of the billionaire donations are going to perpetuate the status quo or protect their own wealth and privilege. And that's really not the intent of our independent sector or of the charitable giving system. And so we may have to reform the rules that govern philanthropy to ensure that the money flows, that people aren't using charity as yet another way to avoid paying their fair share of taxes, and that wealthy people don't create these kind of more private power, pillars of private power that they use to advance their narrow agenda. And that's the risk now with growing billionaire philanthropy.
Thanks again, Chuck. Peace, my friend.
Thanks, Jerry. Peace to you. And thanks to Lee for introducing us too.
We've been listening to the second half of our conversation with Chuck Collins of the Inequality Project. In a future episode, you will hear, we have other places to put our retirement funds other than Wall Street. Have you listened to our recent episodes? In January, we heard about the Safe Harbors Network welcoming immigrants near the San Diego-Tijuana border. In February, we heard about the efforts of Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement to achieve a moratorium on new and enlarged animal confinements to protect our air and water. Do listen. You're sure to pick up thoughts you'll value. We certainly did as we created those episodes. Also, please subscribe to my Simpler Living Daily Nudge to get quick reminders of our blogs, our podcast episodes, and other intriguing happenings and events, such as non-conform freely celebrations, ways to honor rites of passage and holidays without consumerism. Please tell us your thoughts on these subjects. Leave a message on the Simple Living Works Facebook page. Time to wrap up us this episode. Please subscribe to Jubilee Economics, One Earth, and Simple Living Works blogs. As a subscriber, you'll be told when we post something new. Subscriptions are free. Subscribe to our blogs through our websites. You can also subscribe to this podcast under the names The Common Good Podcast and Simple Living Works at iTunes or your favorite podcast service. Urge your friends to do the same. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works with co-host Lee Van Ham of Jubilee One Earth Economics, wishing you well as we strive together to bring simpler One Earth living into being for the common good.
Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others.